John descended back into the murk of the great storm, and down in the dim, blustery, sand-swept days he saw things he hadn't seen before. That was the value of talking with Arkady. He paid attention to things in a new way. He traveled south from Burroughs, for instance, to Sub-Ishii, lonely Mohol, and visited the Japanese who lived there. They were old-timers, the Japanese equivalent of the First Hundred on Mars only 7 years after the First Hundred had arrived, and unlike the First Hundred, they had become a very tight unit and had gone native in a big way. Sub-Ishii had remained small even after the Mohol was dug there. It was out in a region of rough boulders near Jarry de Loge crater, and as he drove down the last part of the transponder trail to the settlement, John caught brief glimpses of boulders carved into oversized faces or figures, or covered with elaborate pictographs, or hollowed out into little Shinto or Zen shrines. He stared in the dust clouds after these visions, but they were always gone like hallucinations, half seen and then disappeared. As he passed into the tattered zone of clear air directly downwind from the Mohol, he noticed that the Sub-Ishiians were taking the rock hauled out of the great shaft to this area and arranging it into curving mounds, a pattern. From space it would look like, what, a dragon? And then he arrived at the garage and was greeted by a group of them, barefoot and long-haired, in frayed tan jumpers or sumo wrestler jockstraps, wizened old Japanese Martian sages who talked about the kami centers in the region and how their deepest sense of own had long ago shifted from the emperor to the planet. They showed him their labs where they were working on aerobotany and radiation-proofed clothing materials. They had also done extensive work on aquifer location and climatology in the equatorial belt. Listening to them, it seemed to John that they just had to be in touch with Hiroko. It didn't make sense that they weren't, but they shrugged when he asked about her. John went to work drawing them out, establishing the atmosphere of trust that he was so often able to generate in old-timers, the sense that they went back a long way together into their own Noachian. A couple of days of asking questions, of learning the town, of showing that he was a man who knew Giri, and slowly they began to open up, telling him in a quiet but blunt way that they didn't like the sudden growth of Burroughs, nor the Mohol next to them, nor the population increase in general, nor the new pressures put on them by the Japanese government to survey the great escarpment and find gold. "We refuse," said Nanao Nakayama, a wrinkled old man with scraggly white whiskers and turquoise earrings and long white hair and a ponytail. "They cannot make us."
"And if they try?" John asked.
"They will fail."
His easy assurance caught John's attention, and John remembered the conversation with Arkady among the mirrors.
So some of the things he now saw were the result of paying attention in a new way, of asking new questions. But others were the result of Arkady sending word down through his network of friends and acquaintances to identify themselves to John and show him around. Thus, when John stopped in settlements on the way from Sub-Ishii to Senzeni-na, he was often approached by small groups of two or three or five who introduced themselves and said, "Arkady thought you might be interested to see this," and they would lead him to see an underground farm with an independent power plant, or a cache of tools and equipment, or a hidden garage full of rovers, or complete little mesa habitats, empty but ready for occupation. John would follow them bug-eyed and slack-jawed, asking questions and shaking his head in amazement. Yes, Arkady was showing him things. There was a whole movement down here, a little group in every town. Eventually, he came to Senzeni-na. He was returning because Pauline had identified two workers there as absent without explanation from their jobs on the day the truck had fallen on him. The day after he arrived, he interviewed them, but they proved to have plausible explanations for their absence from the net. They had been out climbing.
But after he had apologized for taking their time and started back to his room, three other Mohol technicians introduced themselves as friends of Arkady's. John greeted them enthusiastically, glad that something would come of the trip, and in the end a group of eight took him in a rover to a canyon paralleling the Mohol's canyon. They drove down through the obscuring dust to a habitat dug into an overhanging canyon wall. It was invisible to satellites. Its heat was released from a number of dispersed small vents, which from space would look like Sax's old windmill heaters. "We figure that's how Hiroko's group has done it," one of his guides told him. Her name was Marion, and she had a long beak of a nose and eyes that were set too close together so that her gaze was very intent. "Do you know where Hiroko is?" John asked. "No, but we think they're in the chaos." The universal response. He asked them about the cliff dwelling. It had been built, Marion told him, with equipment from Senzeni-Na. It was currently uninhabited, but ready if needed. "Needed for what?" John said as he walked around the little dark rooms of the place. Marion stared at him. "For the revolution, of course." "The revolution!" John had very little to say on the drive back. Marion and her companion sensed his shock, and it made them uneasy, too. Perhaps they were concluding that Arkady had made a mistake in asking them to show John their habitat. "There are a lot of these being prepared," Marion said defensively. Hiroko had given them the idea, and Arkady thought they might come in handy. She and her companions began ticking them off on their fingers, a whole stockpile of air and ice mining equipment, buried in a dry ice tunnel at one of the South Polar Cap processing stations, a well hole tapping the big aquifer under Cassay Vallis, scattered greenhouse labs around Acheron growing pharmacologically useful plants, a communications center in the basement of Nadia's concourse at Underhill. "And that's just what we know about. There are one-read Samizdat appearing in the net that we had nothing to do with, and Arkady's certain that there are other groups out there doing the same thing we are, because when push comes to shove, we're all going to need places to hide and fight from." "Oh, come on," John said. "You all have to get it through your heads that this whole revolution scenario is nothing but a fantasia on the American Revolution, you know, the great frontier, the hardy pioneer colonists exploited by the imperial power, the revolt to go from colony to sovereign state. It's all just a false analogy." "Why do you say that?" Marion demanded. "What's different?" "Well, for one thing, we're not living on land that can sustain us, and for another, we don't have the means to revolt successfully." "I disagree with both those points. You should talk to Arkady more about that." "I'll try. Anyway, I think there's a better way of doing it than all this sneaking around stealing equipment. Something more direct. We simply tell Unoma what the new Mars Treaty is going to say." His companions shook their heads scornfully. "We can talk all we want," Marion said, "but that's not going to change what they do." "Why not? Do you think they can just ignore the people who are living here? They may have continuous shuttles now, but we're still 80 million kilometers away from them, and we're here and they're not. It may not be North America in the 1760s, but we do have some of the same advantages. We're at a great distance, and we're in possession. The important thing is not to fall into their way of thinking, into all the same old violent mistakes." And so he argued against revolution, nationalism, religion, economics, against every mode of Terran thought he could think of, all mashed together in his usual style. "Revolution never even worked on Earth. Not really. And here it's all outmoded. We should be inventing a new program, just like Arkady says, including the ways to take control of our fate. With you all living a fantasy of the past, you're leading us right into the repression you're complaining about. We need a new Martian way, a new Martian philosophy, economics, religion." They asked him just what these new Martian modes of thought might be, and he raised his hands. How can I say? When they've never existed, it's hard to talk about them, hard to imagine them, because we don't have the images. That's always the problem when you try to make something new, and believe me, I know, because I've been trying. But I think I can tell you what it will feel like. It will feel like the first years here, when we were a group and we all worked together. When there was no purpose in life except to settle and discover this place, and we all decided together what we should do. That's how it should feel. But those days are gone, Marion said, and the others nodded. That's just your own fantasy of the past. Nothing but words. It's like you're holding a philosophy class in a giant gold mine, with armies bearing down on both sides. No, no, John said. I'm talking about methods for resistance, methods appropriate to our real situation, and not some revolutionary fantasy out of the history books. And around they went, again and again, until they were back at Senzeni Na and had retired to the workers' rooms on the lowest residential floor. There they argued passionately through the time slip and long into the night, and as they argued, a certain elation filled John, because he could see them beginning to think about it. It was clear that they were listening to him, and that what he said and what he thought of them mattered to them. This was the best return yet on the old first man fishbowl. Combined with Arkady's stamp of approval, it gave him an influence over them that was palpable. He could shake their confidence. He could make them think. He could force them to reevaluate. He could change their minds. And so, in the murky, purple, great storm dawn, they wandered down the halls to the kitchen and talked on, looking out the windows and bolting down coffee, glowing with a kind of inspiration, with the age-old excitement of honest debate. And when they finally quit to go catch a little sleep before the day got going, even Marion was clearly shaken, and all of them were deep in thought, half convinced that John was right. John walked back to his guest suite, feeling tired but happy. Whether Arkady had intended to or not, he had made John one of the leaders of his movement. Perhaps he would come to regret it, but there was no going back now, and John was sure it was for the best. He could be a sort of bridge between this underground and the rest of the people on Mars, operating in both worlds, reconciling the two, forging them into a single force that would be more effective than either alone. A force with the mainstream's resources and the underground's enthusiasm, perhaps. Arkady considered that an impossible synthesis. But John had powers that Arkady didn't. So that he could, well, not usurp Arkady's leadership, but simply change them all. The door to his room in the guest quarters was open. He rushed in, alarmed, and there in the room's two chairs sat Sam Houston and Michael Chang. "So," Houston said, "where have you been?" "Oh, come on," John said. His temper flared, his good mood burnt off in a flash. "Did I pick the wrong door by mistake?" He leaned back out to look. "No, I didn't. These are my rooms." He lifted his arms and clicked on his wrist pad's recorder. "What are you doing in here?" "We want to know where you've been," Houston said evenly. "We've got the authority to enter all the rooms here and to get all our questions answered, so you might as well start." "Come on," John scoffed. "Don't you ever get tired of playing the bad cop? Don't you guys ever trade off?" "We just want answers to our questions," Chang said gently. "Oh, please, Mr. Good Cop," John said. "We all want answers to our questions, don't we?" Houston stood up. Already he was on the edge of losing his temper, and John walked right over to him and stopped with their chests about 10 centimeters apart. "Get out of my rooms," he said. "Get out now or I'll throw you out, and then we'll figure out who had the right to be in here." Houston merely stared at him, and without warning, John shoved him hard in the chest. Houston ran into his chair and sat down involuntarily, bounced up, going for John, but Chang jumped between them, saying, "Wait a second, Sam, wait a second. while John shouted, "Get out of my rooms!" over and over at the top of his lungs, bumping against Chang's back and glaring over his shoulder into Houston's red face. John nearly burst into laughter at the sight. His high spirits had returned with the success of the shove, and he stalked to the door, bellowing, "Get out! Get out! Get out!" so that Houston wouldn't see the grin on his face. Chang pulled his angry colleague out into the hall, and John followed. The three of them stood there, Chang carefully placing himself between his partner and John. He was bigger than either of them, and now he faced John with a worried, irritated look. "Now what did you want?" John said innocently. "We want to know where you've been," Chang said doggedly. "We have reason to suspect that your so-called investigation of the sabotage incidents has been a very convenient cover for you." "I suspect the same of you," John said. Chang ignored him. "Things keep happening right after your visits, you see. They happen right during your visits. Hoppers of dust were dropped in every mohole you visited during the great storm. Computer viruses attacked the software in Sax Russell's office at Eckes Overlook right after your consultation with him in 2047. Biological viruses attacked the fast lichens at Acheron right after you left, and so on." John shrugged. "So? You've been here 2 months, and that's the best you can do?" "If we're right, it's good enough. Where were you last night?" "Sorry," John said. "I don't answer questions from people who break into my rooms." "You have to," Chang said. "It's the law." "What law? What are you going to do to me?" He turned toward the open door of the room, and Chang moved to block him. He lost his temper again and jerked toward Chang, who flinched but remained in the doorway, immovable. John turned and walked away, back down to the commons. He left Senzeni Na that afternoon in a rover and took the transponder road north along the eastern flank of Tharsis. It was a good road, and 3 days later he was 1,300 kilometers to the north, just northwest of Noctis Labyrinthus, and when he came to a big transponder intersection with a new fuel station, he hung a right and took the road east to Underhill. Each day, as the rover rolled along blindly through the dust, he worked with Pauline. "Pauline, would you please look up all planetary records for theft of dental equipment?" She was as slow as a human in processing an incongruous request, but eventually the data were there. Then he had her go over the movement records of every suspect he could think of. When he was sure where everyone had been, he gave Helmut Bronski a call to protest the actions of Houston and Chang. "They say they're working with your authorization, Helmut, so I thought you should know what they're doing." "They are trying their best," Helmut said. "I wish you would stop harassing them and cooperate, John. It could be helpful. I know you have nothing to hide, so why not be more helpful?" "Come on, Helmut, they don't ask for help. It's rank intimidation. Tell them to stop it." "They are only trying to do their job," Helmut said blandly. "I haven't heard of anything illegitimate." John broke the connection. Later on, he called Frank, who was in Burrows. "What's with Helmut? Why is he turning the planet over to these policemen?" "You idiot," Frank said. He was typing madly at a computer screen as he talked, so that he seemed to be only barely conscious of what he was saying. "Aren't you paying any attention at all to what's going on here?"
"I thought I was," John said.
"We're knee-deep in gasoline, and these goddamned aging treatments are the match, but you never understood why we were sent here in the first place, so why should you understand anything now?" He typed on, staring hard into his screen. John studied the little image of Frank on his wrist. Finally, he said, "Why were we sent here in the first place, Frank?" "Because Russia and our United States of America were desperate, that's why. Decrepit, outmoded industrial dinosaurs. That's what we were, about to get eaten up by Japan and Europe and all the little tigers popping up in Asia. And we had all this space experience going to waste, and a couple of huge and unnecessary aerospace industries. And so we pooled them and came here on the chance that we'd find something worthwhile, and it paid off. We struck gold, so to speak. which is only more gasoline poured onto things, because gold rushes show who's powerful and who's not. And now, even though we got a head start up here, there are a lot of new tigers down there who are better at things than we are, and they all want a piece of the action. There's a lot of countries down there with no room and no resources. 10 billion people standing in their own shit. I thought you told me Earth would always be falling apart. This isn't falling apart. Think about it. If this damn treatment only goes to the rich, then the poor will revolt and it'll all explode. But if the treatment goes to everyone, then populations will soar and it'll all explode. Either way, it's gone. It's going now. And naturally, the transnats don't like that. It's horrible for business when the world blows up. So they're scared, and they're deciding to try to hold things together by main force. Helmut and those policemen are only the smallest tip of the iceberg. A lot of policymakers think a world police state for a few decades or so is our only chance of getting to some kind of population stabilization without a catastrophe. Control from above, the stupid bastards. Frank shook his head disgustedly, then leaned toward his screen and became absorbed in its contents. John said, "Did you get the treatment, Frank?" "Of course I did. Leave me alone, John. I've got work to do." The southern summer was warmer than the previous one that had been shrouded in the great storm, but still colder than any recorded. The storm was now almost 2 M-years long, over 3 Terran years, but Sachs was philosophical about it. John called him at Ekkus Overlook, and when John mentioned the cold nights he was experiencing, Sachs only said, "We'll very likely have low temperatures for the greater part of the terraforming period. But warmer, per se, isn't what we're trying for. Venus is warm. What we want is survivable. If we can breathe the air, I don't care if it's cold." Meanwhile, it was cold. Cold everywhere. The nights down to 100 below every night, even on the equator. When John reached Underhill, a week after leaving Senzeni Na, he found there was a kind of pink ice covering the sidewalks. It was all nearly invisible in the storm's dim light, and walking around was a treacherous business. The people at Underhill spent most of their time indoors. John occupied a few weeks by helping the local bioengineering team field test a new fast snow algae. Underhill was crowded with strangers. Most of them were young Japanese or Europeans who fortunately still used English to communicate with each other. John roomed in one of the old barrel vaults near the northeast corner of the quadrant. The old quadrant was less popular than Nadja's concourse, smaller and dimmer, and many of its vaults were now used for storage. It was strange to walk the square of hallways, remembering the pool, Maya's room, the dining hall, now all dark and stacked with boxes. Those years when the first 100 had been the only 100, it was getting hard to remember what that had been like. He kept track, through Pauline, of the movements of quite a few people, the Unoma investigating force among them. It was a not very rigorous surveillance, as it wasn't always easy to track the investigators, especially Houston and Chang and their crew, who he suspected were going off-net deliberately. Meanwhile, the spaceport's arrival records gave more evidence every month that Frank had been right about them being only the tip of the iceberg. A lot of people coming down at Burroughs in particular were working for Unoma without job specifications, and then spreading out to the mines and moholes and other settlements, and going to work for the local security heads. And their Terran employment records were very interesting indeed. Often at the end of a session with Pauline, John would leave the quadrant and go for a walk outside, feeling disturbed and thinking hard. There was a lot more visibility than there had been. Things were clearing up a bit out on the surface, though the pink ice still made walking tricky. It seemed the great storm was lessening. Wind speeds on the surface were only 2 or 3 times the pre-storm average of 30 kilometers per hour, and the dust in the air was sometimes little more than a kind of thick haze, turning the sunsets into blazing pastel swirls of pink, yellow, orange, red, and purple, with random streaks of green or turquoise appearing and disappearing, along with ice bows and sun dogs, and occasional brilliant shafts of pure yellow light. Nature at her most tasteless, transient, and spectacular. And watching all that hazy color and movement, John would be distracted from his thoughts and climb the Great White Pyramid to have a look around, and then go back inside, ready to start the fight again. One evening after one of these sunset extravaganzas, he climbed down the peak of the Great Pyramid and walked slowly back toward Underhill. And then he spotted two figures climb out of one of the garage side doors and down a clear crawl tube into a rover. There was something quick and furtive in their motion, and he stopped to look closer. They didn't have their helmets on, and he recognized Houston and Chang by the backs of their heads and the size of their bodies. They moved with scurrying Terran inefficiency into the rover and drove toward him. John polarized his faceplate and started walking again, head down, trying to look like someone coming in from work, veering to the side a bit to increase the distance between him and them. The rover plunged into a thick dust cloud and disappeared abruptly. By the time he got to the locked doors, he was deep in thought and almost frightened. He stood motionlessly at the door, thinking it over, and when he moved, it wasn't to the door, but to the intercom console in the wall next to the door. There were several different kinds of jacks under the speakers, and carefully he unplugged the stopper in one and cleared away the fines crusting the edge. These jacks were never used anymore, and plugged in his wrist pad. He tapped in the code for Pauline and waited for encryption and decryption to work through. "Yes, John?" said Pauline's voice from his helmet intercom speaker. "Turn on your camera, please, Pauline, and pan my room." Pauline was sitting on the side table by his bed, plugged into the wall. Her camera was a little fiber thing, rarely used, and the image on his wrist pad was small, and the room was dim with only a nightlight on. And his faceplate's curve was yet another barrier, so that even with the wrist pad right against it, he couldn't quite make out the images, gray shapes shifting. There was the bed, there was something on it, then the wall. "Back 10 degrees, John said, and squinted, trying to comprehend the 2-centimeter square image, his bed. There was a man lying on his bed. Wasn't that what it was? The bottom of a shoe, torso, hair. It was hard to tell. It didn't move. "Pauline, do you hear anything in the room? The vents? The electricity? Transmit to me what you're picking up on your mic at full volume." He leaned his head to the left against his helmet, cramming his ear against the helmet speaker. A hiss, a whoosh, static. There was too much transmission error in a process like this, especially using these corroded old jacks, but certainly he heard no breathing. "Pauline, can you enter the Underhill monitoring system and locate our vault's door camera and transmit its image to my wrist, please?" He had directed the installation of Underhill's security system just a few years before. Pauline still had all the plans and codes, and it didn't take long for her to replace the image on his wrist with that of the suite outside his room, seen from above. The suite's lights were on, and in the camera's sweeps, he could see that his door was shut. That was all. He let his wrist fall to his side and thought it over. 5 minutes passed before he raised it again and began giving instructions through Pauline to the Underhill security system. Possession of the codes allowed him to instruct the entire camera system to erase its surveillance tapes, and then to run them in an hour loop rather than the usual 8 hours. Then he instructed two of the cleaning robots to come to his room and open its door. While they did that, he stood shivering, waiting for them to make their slow roll through the vaults. When they opened his door, he saw them through Pauline's little eye. Light poured into the room and momentarily blazed, then adjusted, and he had a much clearer view. Yes, it was a man on his bed. John's breath went shallow. He teleoperated the robots using the minute button toggles on his wrist pad. It was a jerky procedure, but if lifting the man woke him up, so much the better. It didn't. The man lolled down on both sides of the robot's cradling arms, which lifted him with their algorithmic delicacy. A body hanging down. The man was dead. John deliberately took a deep breath, then held it and continued the teleoperation, directing the first robot to deposit the body in the second robot's big trash hopper. Sending the robots back down the hall to their storage vault was easy. Several people walked by them as they rolled along, but there was nothing he could do about that. The body wasn't visible except from above, and hopefully no one was paying enough attention to remember the robots later. When he got them in their storage room, he hesitated. Should he take the body to the incinerators in the alchemist's quarter? But no. Now that it was out of his room, he didn't need to get rid of the body. In fact, he would need it later. For the first time, he wondered who it was. He directed the first robot to put its extensor eye against the body's right wrist and read with its magnetic imager. It took a long time for the eye to hit the right spot on the wrist, then it held fast. The tiny tag that everyone had implanted on a wrist bone held information in the standard DOT language, and it only took a minute for Pauline to get an ID. Yashika Mui, Unoma Auditor, based at Underhill, arrive 2050. An actual person. A man who might have lived 1,000 years. John began to shiver. He leaned against the glazed blue brick wall of Underhill. It would be an hour before he could go inside, or a little less. Impatiently, he pushed off and walked around the quadrant. It took about 15 minutes to walk around it usually, but now he found he was doing it in 10. After the second turn, he walked over to the trailer park. Only 2 of the old trailers were still there, and they were apparently abandoned or used only for storage. Figures loomed out of the night dust between them, and for a second he was afraid, but they passed on by. He returned to the quadrant and circled it again, then walked out the path to the alchemist's quarter. He stood looking at the antiquated complex of tubes and piping and squat white buildings, all covered with their black calligraphic equations. He thought of their first years and how it had come to this in what seemed like the blink of an eye. In the gloom of the great storm. Civilization, corruption, crisis. Murder on Mars. He gritted his teeth. An hour had passed. It was 9 p.m. He went back to the lock and went inside, took off his helmet and walker and boots in the changing room, and stripped, went into the showers and showered, dried off and put on a jumper, combed his hair. He took a deep breath and walked around the south side of the quadrant and up through the vaults to the one with his room. As he was opening his door, he wasn't surprised to see 4 of the Unoma investigators appear, but he tried to act surprised when they ordered him to stop. "What's this?" he said. It wasn't Houston or Chang, but 3 men with 1 of the women from that first group at Low Point. The men clustered at his sides without really responding to him and pulled his door completely open, and 2 of them went inside. John controlled the urge to punch them or shout at them or laugh at the expressions that came over their faces when they saw that his room was empty. He merely stared curiously at them and tried to limit himself to the irritation he would have shown had he been ignorant of what was going on. This irritation would have been considerable, of course, and once he opened that door inside himself, it was hard indeed to keep all his fury from banging through, hard to keep it to an innocence level. They had to be snapped at as if they were overzealous policemen rather than assaulted as murderous functionaries. In their confusion at the unexpected situation, he managed to drive them off with a few biting sentences, and when he had closed the door on them, he stood in the middle of his room. "Pauline, transmit what's happening on the security system to yourself, please, and record. Show me whatever cameras have them." So Pauline tracked them. It only took a couple of minutes for them to go to the security control room, where they were joined by Chang and the others. They went after the camera packs. John sat at Pauline's screen and watched right along with them as they ran the loops back and found that they were only an hour long, and that the events of the afternoon had been erased. That would give them something to think about. He smiled grimly and told Pauline to get off the system. A wave of exhaustion swept through him. It was only 11, but all adrenaline and the morning's dose of Omegendorf had drained out of him, and he was tired. He sat on his bed, but then remembered what had last been there and got up. In the end, he slept on the floor. He was awakened in a time slip by Spencer Jackson with news of a body discovered in a robot hopper. He went and stood wearily beside Spencer in the clinic, staring at the body of Yashica Mui while several of the investigators eyed him warily. The diagnostic machinery was as good at autopsy as anything else, maybe better. Tests of samples were indicating a blood coagulant. Somberly, John ordered a full criminal autopsy. Mui's body and clothes had to be scanned, and all microscopic particles read against his genome, and all foreign particles read against the list of people who were currently in Underhill. John stared at the Unoma investigators as he gave this instruction, but they didn't blink. Probably they had been wearing gloves and walkers, or teleoperated the whole thing as he had. He had to turn away to hide his disgust. He couldn't let on that he knew. But then, of course, they knew that they had put the body there, and so they must suspect that he was the one who had removed it and erased the camera tapes. So they already knew that he knew, or suspected he did. But they couldn't be sure, and there was no reason to give anything away. An hour later, he went back to his room and lay on the floor again. Although he was still exhausted, he could no longer sleep. He stared at the ceiling, thinking it over. Thinking over everything that he had learned. Near dawn, he felt he had things sorted out. He gave up on sleep and got up to go out for another walk. He needed to be outside, away from the human world and all its sickening corruption, out into the great rush of the wind, made so dramatically visible by the storm's flying dust. But when he got out of the locked door, there were stars overhead, the complete net of them, all the thousands burning as of old, without the slightest twinkle or flicker, the faint ones so dense that the black sky itself appeared slightly whitish, as if the whole sky were the Milky Way. When he had recovered from his astonishment and the almost forgotten wonder of the stars, he got on his intercom and called in the news. It caused pandemonium. People heard and woke their friends and rushed down to the changing rooms to grab a walker before the supply was exhausted, and the locked doors started opening and spewing out crowds. The sky to the east turned a blackish red and then lightened quickly. The whole sky shifted to a dark rose shade and then began to glow. The stars disappeared by the hundreds until only Venus and the Earth hung in the east over a growing intensity of light. The sky in the east grew brighter and brighter again, until it seemed brighter than day could ever get. Even behind faceplates, people's eyes watered, and some cried out over the common band at the sight. There were figures scampering around, the intercom babbling, the sky growing impossibly brighter and brighter and brighter yet, until it seemed it would burst. It pulsated with glowing pink light, the dots that were Venus and Earth overwhelmed by it. And then the sun cracked the horizon and fountained across the plain like a thermonuclear bomb, and the people roared and jumped up and down and ran among the long black shadows of the rocks and the buildings. All east-facing walls were great blocks of fauvist color, their glaze mosaics stunning, hard to look at directly. The air was clear as glass and indeed seemed a solid substance, imbuing the things stuck in it with razor-edged clarity. John walked out, away from the crowds, east toward Chernobyl. He turned his intercom off. The sky was a darker pink than he remembered, with a touch of purple at the zenith. Everyone in Underhill was going crazy. Many of the people there had never seen the sun shine on Mars, and no doubt it felt like they had lived their whole lives in the great storm. Now it was over, and they were wandering out in the sunshine, drunk with it, slipping on pink ice left and right, getting in yellow snowball fights, climbing the frosted pyramids. When John saw that, he turned and went up the steps of the last pyramid himself to have a look at the tors and hollows around Underhill. They were somewhat frosted and silted over, but otherwise just the same. He turned on the common band, but turned it back off. People still inside were howling for walkers, and no one outside was paying any attention to them.
It had been an hour since sunrise, one cried, though John found that hard to believe. He shook his head. The raucous voices and the memory of the body on his bed made it hard to feel much joy in the end of the storm. Eventually, he went back inside and gave his walker over to a pair of women his size who were squabbling over who got to use it next, and he went down to the comm center and called Sachs in Echus Overlook. When he got him, he congratulated him on the end of the storm. Sachs waved this away brusquely, as if it had happened years before. "They've boarded Amor 2051B," he said. This was the ice asteroid they had found for insertion into Martian orbit. They were in the process of installing rockets on it, which would knock it onto a course that would bring it in on a trajectory similar to the Ares. Without a heat shield, the aerobraking would burn it up. All looked well for an MOI ETA about 6 months away. That was the big news, Sachs implied in his blinking calm way. The great storm was history. John had to laugh, but then he thought of Yashica Mui, and he told Sachs about it because he wanted someone else's celebration to be ruined as well. Sachs only blinked. "They're getting serious," he finally said. Disgusted, John said goodbye and got off. He wandered back out through the vaults, disturbed by a fiercely clashing mix of good and bad emotions. He returned to his room and took an Omegendorf and one of the new Pandorfs Spencer had given him, and then he went out into the quadrant central atrium and wandered among the plants, all skinny storm spawn, troping toward the light bulbs running overhead. The sky was still a clear, dark pink, still very bright. A lot of the people who had gone out first were now back and in the atrium between the rows of crops, partying. He ran into a few friends, some acquaintances, mostly strangers. He went back into the vaults, through rooms full of strangers who sometimes cheered when he walked in. If they yelled speech long enough, he would stand on a chair and rattle something off, feeling the endorphins, which today were rendered unpredictable in their effect by the thought of the murdered man. Sometimes he was pretty vehement, and he never knew what he was going to say until it came out of him. "We saw John Boone drunk on his ass," they would say, "the day the great storm ended." Fine, he thought. Let them say what they wanted. It never mattered what he did anymore anyway, as far as the legend was concerned. One room contained a crowd of Egyptians, not like his Sufis, but Orthodox Muslims, talking like the wind and drinking cups of coffee, high on caffeine and sunlight, flashing white smiles under their mustaches, extremely cordial for once, in fact pleased to see him there. He warmed to that, and flying on the momentum of the day, he said, "Look, we're part of a new world. If you don't base your actions on Martian reality, then you become a kind of schizophrenic, with your body on one planet and your spirit on another. No society split like that can function for long." "Well, well," one of them said with a smile. "You must understand we have traveled before. We are a traveling people. But wherever we are, Mecca is our spirit's home. We could fly to the other side of the universe, and that would still be true." Nothing to say to that. And in fact, such direct honesty was so much cleaner than what he had been dealing with through the night that he nodded and said, "I see. I understand." Compare that, after all, to the hypocrisy of the West, where people talked of profit at prayer breakfasts, people who couldn't articulate a single belief they had, people who thought their values were physical constants, who would say, "That's just the way things are," like Frank so often did. So John stayed and talked with the Egyptians for a while, and when he left them, he was feeling better. He wandered back to his vault, listening to the rowdy voices pouring into the hallway from every room. Shouts, shrieks, happy scientist talk. "These things are such halophytes that they don't like brine because there's too much water in it." Peals of laughter. He had an idea. Spencer Jackson lived in the vault next door to John's and was passing through when John hurried in, so John told him the idea. "We ought to gather everyone we can for a big celebration of the storm's end. All the sort of Mars-centered groups, you know, or really everyone who can possibly make it, anyone who wants to be there, Where?
Up on Olympus Mons, he said without considering it. We could probably get Sax to time the arrival of his ice asteroid so that we could watch it from there.
Good idea, Spencer said.